From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Things are changing in our understanding about sexual orientation and attraction. For decades, we figured these attractions were fixed, that you were drawn to the opposite sex or the same sex. But then the research started to reveal a difference between men and women, that women could be more flexible in their sexual chemistry. Often this was based on relationships and love. Well, there's another shift going on. The psychologist Lisa Diamond says we're learning that it's not just women who are fluid in their sexuality. Men are too. That's the word we'll use today to describe the program. We're talking about fluidity with Lisa Diamond and the surprisingly diverse spectrum of human sexuality. We hope you'll join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For nearly 20 years now, the psychologist Lisa Diamond has been researching human sexuality, in particular the sexual fluidity in women, that is, an inclination in women to change their sexual identity over time. One thing she learned was that certain relationships could in some ways transform women's sexual attraction, that a woman who could experience a loving relationship could be transformed into a sexual one that would sort of change her identity. Now, that revelation made Lisa Diamond rethink everything she understood about sexuality. At first, she and other researchers figured only women had this kind of fluidity, but they're rethinking things again as they're learning. Men, it turns out, are flexible too. So today in the program, Lisa Diamond is joining us to discuss what we know and what we're learning about sexual orientation and attraction. Lisa Diamond is a professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah, author of the book Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. It came out in 2008, broke new ground in the scientific study of sexual orientation. And Lisa Diamond, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
Well, I guess I was interested in what it was that drew you to this line of study, oh, these so many years ago now. How much of it was based on your own sexuality, and how much of it was based on feminism, or was it a mix of both?
Yeah, it really wasn't based on my own experiences at all. And in fact, in some ways, I think that was good because my own surprise and my own kind of bewilderment at some of what I was finding, I think at first as a graduate student, I was like, wait, this is kind of weird and I don't understand the data. And then part of me was like, well, maybe that's good. Maybe that means I'm actually learning something. Yeah. Oh, that's what graduate students are supposed to do.
So if it would have been personal, you wouldn't have maybe paid the
Yeah,
same
maybe
kind of attention.
My own biases would have just led me to be like, oh, well, that's exactly, you know, what my experience was like. So that must be true. But what really led me into it was just the lack of developmentally oriented research on women's sexual identity and orientation. At that time, in the early 90s, it was still the field of adolescent sexual identity development was still a relatively new field. And most of the published research that was out there that I was, you know, eagerly consuming was based on samples of men. And so I guess where my feminism came in is like, you know, the sort of automatic thing is, oh my gosh, we're making conclusions about all sexuality based on studies of men. And so, ta-da, that will be my contribution. I will study women. And so I didn't have a very clear idea at that time of what I was looking for. You know, again, this was, you know, the beginning of my graduate training. And I figured, well, I'll just let it be sort of open-ended. I'm just going to capture kind of women who are relatively early in the questioning process. I'm going to make sure to capture women who identify as bisexual as well as lesbian, because there wasn't a lot of research on bisexuals, and individuals who didn't label their sexual identity, because a critique that had been raised at that time, and which is just as important now, is that if you restrict your samples to openly identified lesbian and gay and bisexual individuals, there's really a tiny portion of the population of individuals with same-sex sexuality, yeah. and you've already biased the sample. So I ended up with a pretty good mixed sample of young women that I just found by just driving in my beat-up Toyota Corolla all over New York State to every large city that I could get to.
Now, this was in the day before email.
Yeah, there was no
right?
there was no email. Yeah. There was there was no internet. Yeah. It was just like, I'm just going to go to a bunch of pride parades and community centers and post things and word of mouth. It was just like boots on the ground. And I was looking for women who were between the ages of 16 and 23, which is a early enough age that that process is still sort of actively being negotiated. And I just interviewed women. Mm-hmm. And then I kept interviewing them every 2 years. And that was what really ended up being so transformative was, the first interview was about just how they came to an awareness of their same-sex attractions right. and what their relationships were like. And then every 2 years, I would recontact them. And now it's been, 7 waves of data collection. Mm. And what ended up being so startling was how many women at each and every follow-up assessment were changing the way that they thought about their sexual identity, often based on the relationships and experiences that
they had. Well, that's the thing that I wanted to ask you about, because this is something you've talked about, is that you were doing these sets of interviews, and all of a sudden you started to realize that you were getting in these responses people who were saying it was a relationship that – it was a really close, deep relationship I was having with this person, and it made me shift my sense of sexual attraction or identity. And at first, you kind of dismissed it.
Yeah, I had the same response that I think a lot of folks in the LGBT community would have, like, oh, well, that's just your way, your like nice, soft greeting card way of explaining the fact that, you're a lesbian.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I just loved you so much because that's a story that anyone who spent any time in the queer community, that's a story people have heard from friends, from loved ones. And everyone kind of does a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like, yeah, I thought that too. But what was really interesting was that I had the opportunity to then come back 2 years later and be like, oh, so that's how you characterize that relationship at the time. And I was sort of ready for some of these women to be like, yeah, I think I was just in denial. And they were like, no, that's pretty much, I still kind of think that, like, and that's just what happened. And I think that's part of the power of just watching lives unfold over time rather than asking folks in retrospect, because I think retrospectively, we would all like to believe that our lives are more linear and make a lot of sense. And one of the things that I think fluidity makes for in a life course is a lot of change and unexpected transition. And that can be scary when it's actually happening. And so if you only find out about it after the fact, that gives people plenty of time to sort of tie a nice bow. But when you capture folks in the midst of that experience, then you get these stories that seem kind of crazy, like all of a sudden I was cuddling and these sexual feelings came out of nowhere. And it's like, well, that's not the way we normally think about sexuality operating. But in that moment, that was what was happening.
So give us a sense, and we'll sort of work through this as we go. But so how fluid then is human sexuality? And we'll sort of come back around to involving men, which seems to be the new insight or one of the new insights anyway. But we tend to think or have thought about orientation, sexuality in general. And I want to sort of parse these different distinctions. But we tend to think of sexuality as mostly fixed.
Yeah.
But clearly it's more fluid. I mean, that was the thing you were starting to understand. And you write this in your book. We're born with a certain sexual orientation. But those orientations don't provide, as you put it, the last word on sexual attractions and sexual experiences. So how does it work? How fluid are we?
Yeah, I think that one of the important distinctions to make is that we're born with an orientation and we're also born with a certain capacity for fluidity. That I think one of the misconceptions is that, if sexuality is fluid, then there is no sexual orientation. We're all just free-floating, pansensual creatures. And the data just doesn't bear that out. It's an interesting argument, but it just doesn't seem to fit what we have observed. The other thing that I think is important to point out is the capacity for fluidity appears to vary quite a bit from person to person. So even on a level, in the same way that you can have individuals with lesbian or bisexual or heterosexual orientations, you have people with high, medium, and low degrees of fluidity. So I think one of the obstacles in talking about this and thinking about this is I think a lot of people immediately want to sort of figure out how it applies to them. And they're like, well, I know that I'm a lesbian and that's all I've ever been and I'm not fluid, so this can't exist. And it's like, well, you just might not be a very fluid person. So that capacity exists universally, but it can be really big or really small. So it's important for people to not, you know, immediately then jump to the conclusion that everyone, you know, has an endless capacity to then move around in their attractions, because that doesn't appear to be the case.
Well, it's also one of these subjects that's so fraught with the politics. Politics of gay rights, which we'll talk a little bit about that too. But I wanted to get this part out of the way. One of the things that happens from time to time is that people who are opposed to gay rights or gay marriage and think that same-sex attraction, you know, is this immoral lifestyle choice. They've used your research actually to make this. I know this bothers you, but they've used your research to make their case that sexual orientation, then, if it's fluid, that means it's a choice. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, for religious people, it's sort of a way of letting God off the hook.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That attraction isn't biological, isn't just biological. It's some thing in your behavior that you choose. And I wanted you to sort of talk a little bit about that, because this is something that's always bothered you, the way it's used.
And there's two different claims that are often made on the anti-gay side on the basis of fluidity. One is that it must be a choice. The second is that it must be capable of willful change, that reparative therapy must be something that is possible if it's fluid. And the things that I point out is that in none of the women that I've studied the changes that they experienced in their attractions and their behaviors happened to them. They were not willfully undertaken. That some of the women describe them almost like weather systems. You know, it's like then something is happening and I'm as surprised as, you know, everybody else. So the notion that you can choose your attractions, again, just doesn't seem to be borne out by the data. Now, anyone can choose their behavior. And I think that is really the heart of what the sort of anti-gay perspective wants. I mean, I don't think they frankly care what people feel. They want people to choose not to act on those behaviors. So I sort of feel like, well, that's a valid argument to have. Let's have it about what we're actually having it about, which is behavior and identity, which is sort of easier to document than attraction. And I think the more legitimate political argument that sort of gets aside of the question of orientation is, should people be allowed to choose their behavior? And I think that there's a fundamental disagreement between people in this country about that question. But that's really the argument. As to the issue of reparative therapy, again, you know, if you look at the data, the changes that the women experienced in their attractions, again, were not sort of willfully chosen. They sort of happened to them. And if this is the thing that's so interesting. What reparative therapy is trying to do is remove same-sex attractions. If there's any pattern that I've been able to observe in my research over time, is that the change in same-sex attraction and in opposite-sex attraction seems to go in one direction. In other words, people seem to get broader as they age and not narrower. That if there's a change that you could force, that change would probably be to develop new attractions, whether they're same-sex attractions or opposite-sex attractions. But removing attractions that you already have appears to be what's not possible. If there's any trajectory, it appears to be toward more diversity, more openness. So that, you know, doesn't really speak well for the project of trying to eliminate a pattern of attractions.
You know, I wonder, this idea of reparative therapy often comes at this idea of redirecting the fluidity in sexual orientation. And you often hear this idea that, for example, if two women can have a deep relationship, a loving relationship that over time transforms itself into something sexual, why couldn't, I guess a reparative therapist would say, why couldn't you take a man who has a same-sex attraction and say, go get married to a woman? This happens a lot in religious communities.
And actually, I've talked to many people who got exactly that advice. And what I find interesting about that is that that's probably the most valid way to, you know, and I say valid in quotes because I think the whole project of reparative therapy is flawed, but that's the most valid, you know, sort of use of the research. Could you develop an erotic relationship with your heterosexual wife over time if you love her enough? Possibly. Now, is that a worthwhile project to undertake in a marriage, knowing that it might not work? Maybe not. But I have actually had some really profound conversations with LDS men here in Utah who've come to my talks and who've said, you know, I'm basically a gay man and I'm married. And my marriage is going pretty well, and I have an unbelievable bond to my wife. And I have not been able to understand why I can have such a strong bond to my wife, even though she's not, you know, even though I'm attracted to men. And your book helps me understand why I'm able to do that. And I think it's a, you know, you can argue about whether that's healthy or unhealthy, but
yeah.
But does our kind of erotic and affectional phenomenology allow for that? Yeah, I think it does. And I think that that's a part of what we should take into account when we think about what is or should be possible in human relationships, and then what standards or expectations or information, you know, we want to build on that.
Well, one of the connections you talk about, and it seems like this may apply here, is it seems like we have never accounted for, or haven't very well in social science research, at least regarding human sexuality, is the part of love, like romantic love.
Yeah. It's been something that I have kind of railed about for years, because even the academic societies that study loving relationships and that study sexuality have literally nothing to do with one another. They're different organizations. Yeah. They have different academic meetings. They have different journals. They don't read each other's work. I actually gave a talk at one of the relationship conferences a number of years ago called Where's the Sex in Relationship Research? Because I do think that part of the slowness in our understanding of these things is that there isn't a lot of crosstalk between the disciplines. Folks studying sexuality have figured that relationships are just the other thing, that the context in which you sometimes have sex, but sometimes you have sex not in a relationship, so who cares?
Yeah.
And then the relationship folks are interested in sex, sort of, but basically at the level of, are you satisfied with your sexual relationship with your partner? And that ends up being kind of the end of the question.
But you're saying they're intricately connected.
I think they are intricately connected. And part of what led me to that conclusion was just looking at the emerging field of research on the neurobiology of both sexuality and romantic love. Like, we are far more advanced than we used to be in understanding the brain systems that underlie these, you know, intense human experiences. And they are both overlapping and distinct, both at the level of hormonal factors, at the level of brain structure and function, and at the level of their evolution. So we know a lot about how they should be connected, and at a you know, a sort of a deep functional level. And I think that's knowledge that we now have to, I think, be more responsible about using.
We'll say a little bit more about that. So what you're saying is that our sense of love is affecting our plastic brains.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. One of the most powerful and transformative effects on the human neural circuitry for love is the quality of the infant caregiver bond in the first 6 months of life. So our brains—
Which is physically transforming
the brain. It physically changes the way that the brain responds to social feedback, to social cues. It actually changes the way humans process positive and negative emotions. And the argument for why there is that much plasticity is that the quality of that bond is a signal to the developing organism as to how dangerous the environment is, that as a part of evolution, we come into the world, and the most important thing for the organism to sort of be attuned to is, am I in a dangerous environment or am I in a relatively safe and secure environment? And we now know that the feedback that the infant gets right away about how dangerous the environment is and how much nurturance is available fundamentally changes the life history of that organism. It changes the age of pubertal maturation. It changes responses to stress. It changes so many things. So our brains take those cues from the caregiver as some of the most important cues about how to grow up in this environment, whether it's safe and loving and nurturing or whether it's not. And one of the ways we see that outcome is the way individuals form both sexual and romantic bonds, you know, after pubertal maturation.
So it doesn't just harden the brain after you become a child and you establish good relationships with your parents. It's not over yet. Our brain continues to make changes based on our
Absolutely. There are certain times of life that are more plastic than others.
Sure.
And folks are, you know, under a lot of sort of active debate over how big those windows are. And so some of the current thinking is that there's a lot of plasticity early on in the first 6 months, that there may be another window of plasticity at around the time that children form peer networks and begin to separate a little bit from their parents. And that's typically, you know, 8 or 9 years of age. Or a little earlier. And then pubertal maturation is another big window of plasticity. And those are all times that, you know, in our human evolution, it's time for the organism to figure out, what kind of environment do I have? Is it going to make sense for me to reproduce quickly because I might actually die? Or is it safe enough that I can reproduce slowly and invest in one or two offspring and not just churn them out as fast as I can? So, you know, all of these things that we think of as being, you know, choices that we make about our life, you know, we have been wired by evolution to be prepared to take in cues from the environment and to then have urges and feelings that seem unexplainable, but they are explainable if you think about the life history of the organism.
So I don't want to distill this too much, but loving relationships, basically, it's about me feeling safe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
Security,
yeah.
The sort of operational definition of love from the perspective of, you know, what's called attachment research is security, is having a secure base from which to explore the world.
So it seems clear that sexuality is something we're born with, our orientation. But the term fluidity does raise the question of how it's influenced by these certain environmental conditions, relationships we talked about. And I want to come back to that if we can. What about culture? What about upbringing? Those kinds of things.
The studies seem to show is that upbringing, in terms of sort of because there used to be a lot of theories about smothering moms.
Yeah, yeah. This
or
is a huge one too.
Dads.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one thing we've pretty much ruled out, that there doesn't appear to be much of an influence of how close or distant your parents were. If you're within the normal range of parental relationships, there's not much variation in sexuality that can be accounted for that. Where you see a lot of variation is in the overall restrictiveness of the culture at large. And the main influence there is simply sort of slowing any sort of expression of whatever kind of tendencies may be there, and kind of stunting awareness of broader ranges of possibilities. And that's one thing that has changed quite dramatically because of the internet. It used to be that if you were someone living in a really conservative, tiny town, no open discussion of sexuality, and you might have been completely repressed 20 years ago, well, now you could be that same person, and with the click of a mouse, you can have access to all the information that you're not getting in your church, in your school, from your parents. And so it used to be that those kind of local cultural effects were extremely profound. They're now competing with a broad array of information on the internet that is changing the degree of restrictiveness that cultures can provide, which is a good thing on one hand. On the other hand, there's a lot of misinformation on the internet, right? So if that's your source of information, you know, there are some problems there. But I think in general, there's far more knowledge and visibility about sexual possibilities on all fronts available to individuals, even living in very restrictive cultural environments.
Lisa Diamond is with us, professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah, author of Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Professor Lisa Diamond, Professor of Psychology and Gender Studies at the University of Utah. We're talking about human sexuality, in particular how sexual attraction works. We used to think about our sexual orientation and our attractions as being fixed, but Professor Diamond says it happens to be who she, by the way, we should mention she has one of the world's experts in this field. She says it's pretty complicated, much more complicated than we thought. And one of the things, Professor Diamond, that we used to think, I guess, was this understanding was that there was a big gender difference, mm-hmm. that women were more likely to be sexually fluid, variable mm-hmm. in their sexuality. But
I was one of the people arguing that there were hugely
I want to just mention the name of a title of a talk you gave not so long ago. I was wrong. Men are pretty darn sexually fluid, too.
I felt I needed to just own up, like...
just start off right
there.
Hey,
you know, I'm not going to lie. Like, my own data is telling me it's something different than I thought. And, you know, I think the reason that it's only now that we are finding that men are fluid, too... it's not that something in men changed. I think it has to do with the types of questions that we started to ask. Mm. One of the you know, in the study that I did that I was talking about in that talk, we asked very detailed questions from the gay and bisexual and heterosexual men in our sample about their sexual histories, about we asked gay men the last time they had masturbated to a fantasy about a woman. We asked heterosexual men how often they masturbated to fantasies about men. We asked about affectional feelings, crushes. We asked the sort of questions that I think once people check the gay or straight box, they're it's like, oh, skip all the questions about attractions right. to the ones that apply to you.
Yeah.
And what I found is that if you just go one step further and say, well, answer all the questions about attractions to men, women, behavior, then all this information started bubbling up. And so I think that this wouldn't be so much of a surprise if we had simply thrown our assumptions out, you know, quite a while ago and asked a broader array of questions to everybody that we were studying and not just assume that once a man checks the gay box, you don't need to ask about the quality of his relationships with women because they will all be terrible.
Right.
And he will never, you know, fantasize about women. It's just a non-issue. And it's not. It's not a non-issue that there is that fluidity even among men as well. And the rates, they're slightly smaller.
But only slightly.
Yeah, exactly. They're not statistically significantly different in the research that I've done. And that just blew my mind because I was getting ready to write this. I'm like, oh, I'm going to now show because everyone's like, oh, you need to get a comparison group of men. So I'm like, oh, now I have this great comparison group of men. And they're actually not that different from the women.
It seems like – I wonder, has that changed the trajectory of your research that you're more interested in the men part for a while?
I had been more interested in studying men. Largely, it was just a matter of like how many hours there are in the day. But we're like, you should do a study of men. And I would say, you should do a study of men. I've got my hands full. But now that I've started studying men, you know, I think the comparisons are incredibly interesting. There are and the thing is there are some women I've studied – who are more male-like, at least in terms of the stereotype of men being more fixed. There are lesbians in my sample who are about as rigid as they can be. And then there are men in my sample who look like our stereotype of women. So gender does not appear to kind of neatly cut the world into two halves on that front. And so then the question is, and this is a question I truly don't know the answer to, why are some individuals more fluid than others? Why is it such a strong individual difference dimension, almost like a personality trait? Is that something that you're born with as well, some degree of fluidity? Is that something that gets tuned or calibrated early in life around the same time that some of these other relationship things are being calibrated? And that, to me, right now is the $6 million question.
It seems like that is the question in a lot of areas of just understanding human beings in general. How does it work, the nurture part with the nature part?
Yeah.
And at what part does the nurture part come into play with the stuff that's already fixed
and
by
how
nature?
Modifiable is it?
Right.
And is it, you know, sensitive to change? And I you know, one of the other, I think, reasons it's so interesting is I've talked to many men and women who will say, you know, you really need to study the later half of the lifespan. You know, it seems to me that everything changes after 50 or after the, like, all, you know, the whole sexual system is like, you know, reset. And, you know, because I'm not in my 50s, I have no, you know, personal experience with this. But it's been interesting. It never would have occurred to me to treat that as like a particular period for more expansion. But many people in their 50s and 60s have come up to me and said, oh, you need to look at that stage of life because something changes, you know, something powerful changes there too. And maybe even if you weren't so fluid before then, maybe that's another window of openness or opportunity.
It's almost like a experience, maturity.
It's interesting. You know, my first instinct, you know, is that some of that must have to do with the change in the cultural obligations, right? If your children are grown, if you've done a good job, you know, providing for your family, and you don't have these other worries and pressures, there may be more freedom for individuals to just do a little more self-exploration without the sort of routine pressures of life. I think another thing that happens is, you know, there's plenty of folks whose marriages, you know, break up in those years. And the end of one stable relationship is obviously an opportunity to discover other possibilities. And that may be a part of it as well.
It seems like you often heard in the past that women are more – tend to be more – their relationships tend to be more based on emotion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Men aren't that necessarily inclined. Do we have to throw that up too?
Well, I think there's a yes and no. Women are much more expressive about their you know, relationship-based emotions than men are. Women, at least women in the contemporary West, tend to develop intimacy through emotional talk and emotional communication. Men historically have been more likely to develop intimacy through activities, through shared activities, and they don't talk. And so it's like they're having the same emotions. They may not be expressing them the same way. But there's no evidence that men are less emotional in their relationships. It's just that the outward expression of those emotions is not as critical to men's experience of intimacy as it is.
Is that a cultural expectation?
That appears to be largely cultural, because if you look at other cultures, you see very different patterns. There are cultures in which men are much more physically affectionate with other men as well as with their female partners. So I do think a lot of that has to do with the way we raise children. I mean, we know that parents use more emotion words with girl children than boy children in the first, you know, 2 years of life. So we would kind of tell girls that emotions are central to your identity. You should talk about them. You should think about them. That's what girls are about. And we give boys a very different message. And I think that's how that plays out in relationships.
Here's a question that comes from Jeremy. He writes, does this have any impact on an individual relationship level? For example, falling into and out of love with a particular person?
That's a great question. I actually, you know, I have to give Jeremy credit. At this point, I always think I've thought of every question that could come up. But I actually hadn't really thought about the issue of falling in and out of love with the same person. But we know that that happens, and we know that there are relationships that, you know, flare out and then up and then out again. I think it absolutely could. I mean, I think that that, again, that sort of – if we think about fluidity as a capacity for that sexual system to be open for input from the environment, then I think it absolutely could have an impact on an individual relationship. And it may be one of those cases where the two individuals in the relationship have very different experiences of that. One of them might be far more flexible and far more able to experience a resurgence of passion than the other. So it may create a lot of tension and conflict.
So it's a continuum in some way, but there's not a particular trajectory. They don't start out experimental and they get fixed and then you're settled. It's you're coming back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think this sort of openness to input is the best sort of operationalization of fluidity, that it's this ability to just take in information and respond to it. It's almost like the system is more porous to what's around it.
So there's no such thing as closure of that necessarily.
Well, it's a good question. You know, is it possible that something can close it down at a certain point in life? I think possibly. One of the things that I did observe in the women that I studied over time is that if they were in a really, really stable relationship, they would often say, you know, my sexuality is really about my partner right now. And so my partner is my focus, and that's – you know, so maybe I still have, you know, an ability to do X or Y, but I'm not even thinking about it because I'm just so focused on my partner. Mm-hmm. And I think that as individuals get into very stable, committed relationships, that can be a part of that kind of, you know, so it's not closing down the capacity, but it's certainly sort of temporarily kind of orienting the system around the preferred target.
Professor Lisa Diamond is with us, professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah, author of the book Sexual Fluidity. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Professor Lisa Diamond, professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah, about human sexuality, how sexual attraction works. Sexual fluidity, really, is the thing we're talking about. That's the name of her book, groundbreaking book, Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. Are you ever thinking about taking that women's part out and just saying people's? I mean, you know what I mean? Has it changed that much?
I think it is changing that much. And it's funny because my advisor in graduate school, Rich Chevin Williams, you know, who's been my champion in so many ways in this work, when I gave the talk on, you know, I was wrong, and he came up to me, he's like, you know, I'm so relieved because I was finding in my own research that some of the men were kind of fluid, and I didn't want to like have to have this difficult conversation with you where I was like, you know, honey, I think you're wrong. Yeah. And he's like, so I'm relieved that we're both finding the same thing and I don't have to have this, you know, uncomfortable talk.
Let's talk about bisexuality because you've talked about individuals who identify as bisexual or those who say they have experienced sexual attraction to men and women. They used to be, and I don't know if this is still the case, but you've sort of complained that they've been ignored by social scientists.
They say that's absolutely true. They still have been. And it's interesting. I was recently at a consortium that was thrown together and but was really exciting, held at the Fenway Community Center in Boston. And they really pulled together a whole bunch of folks who were studying and thinking about bisexuality, because there was just this awareness that both on the level of community resources and community activism and social science research, that there was such a gaping hole that they were like, maybe we should just develop this, you know, group of people to go out there and like release a paper or do something. But it's crazy that it's 2014 and nothing much has changed from even 15 years ago. And we've just gotten a steady progression of amazing data collected in the United States and in many other countries, just basically proving without a shadow of a doubt that individuals with bisexual patterns of attraction are far more common than individuals with exclusive patterns of attraction. They represent the prototypical type of same-sex attracted individual, even though everybody seems to believe it's the opposite, that the prototypical queer person is a gay or lesbian person.
Right.
And then you have this smattering of bisexual individuals and nobody really knows what to do about them. And it's absolutely reversed. The most common type of same-sex attraction is to be mostly but not completely attracted to the opposite sex. So this category called mostly heterosexual, which is a category that, you know, no one has ever studied. People are like, oh, they don't count, they're confused or whatever, has reliably shown up in every single social science survey that's been done and random representative surveys with like amazing methodology as the single largest group of same-sex attracted individuals. And they're a huge group. They represent something like, you know, like 11% of wow. women and something like 8% of men. And if you look at individuals who consider themselves exclusively attracted to the same sex, you're talking about less than 1% of women and something like 2% of men. So they are far outnumbered by folks that are functionally bisexual. And yet, because we tend to do studies that recruit for the gays and lesbians, we've just been systematically throwing their data away for years and years and years.
This is another one of those ones where sort of I guess politics comes into play.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This issue, and you hear this a lot, that, look, I know you're saying you're bi right now.
But
it's a stage.
Yeah.
This is a phase that you're going through. It's just your way of sort of transitioning from where you thought you were
yeah.
to where you really are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the gay community really – Dan Savage, the sex columnist, has been sort of criticized for that. I mean he said this. He said, I meet somebody who's 19 years old who tells me he's bisexual and I'm like, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt it. Come
mm-hmm.
back when you're 29 and we'll see.
I think there are two things that sort of account for that sort of perception that – and that perception I think is stronger in the gay men's community than in the women's community. And that's – there's a good reason for that. There are just statistically more bisexually attracted women in the world than bisexually attracted men. So the gay community, the gay male community has had more distrust of bisexuality. I think it's based on the reality that they see on the ground. But, you know, if you take that scenario that Dan Savage put out there, a 19-year-old, you know, bisexual saying, oh, I'm bisexual. The truth is that if you look at the studies, 19-year-old bisexually attracted men are basically totally in the closet. That basically if you have a 19-year-old man saying that he's anything same-sex attracted at all, statistically he's likely to be a gay man, right?
Yeah.
Because the quote-unquote real bisexuals are not even out, especially at that age. Because one of the things we know is that people use the existence of sexual attractions to the opposite sex as a, oh, am I gay? I must not be gay
yeah.
because I know that I'm attracted to the opposite sex. Okay, I'm just not going to think about this anymore. So they tend to have a later coming out trajectory because there's such a ready explanation. I must be confused. I must be this. So I'm not even going to talk about it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to act about it. I'm just going to wait for everything to calm down. So I think by the time you have anyone coming forward and saying, I'm bisexual, oh, and then 6 months later they come out as gay, I think it's because you've got a self-selected sample there. And that experience is not representative of the bisexual experience. What appears to be more representative of the bisexual experience is a lot of silence and a lot of shame. And we're now finding from, you know, sort of health statistics data that the population of individuals with bisexual patterns of attraction and behavior have mental and physical health risks that are far higher in terms of stress-related disorders, depression, anxiety, substance use, far higher than lesbian and gay identified individuals. And this has become a, you know, health disparities in the LGBT population have become a real big topic of research. At the NIH, they now have, you know, a whole request for proposals to study it. The Institute of Medicine just released a big report about the fact that sexual minority individuals have these higher rates of risk. But that risk is higher in bisexuals than it is in gays and lesbians. And that, you know, I think speaks to the fact that we have ignored this whole population and the fact that they are actually facing more stress and more stigma from both sides, right, from the heterosexual community and the gay community than gays and lesbians do. And I think that that accounts for their greater risk.
So it seems like in some way the gay community on some level is as resistant as the heterosexual sort of conventional community to accepting this idea of there being some fluidity.
I think they are.
You have to pick one.
I think they are. And I think a part of it is that, you know, like any minority community that has a sort of, you know, civil rights angle, like we are, you know, we have to fight oppression and we have to come together. This notion that somebody could, you know, be somewhat with you but not completely with you is a threat. What I find sort of instructive historically is that you see similar – if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, you see similar distrust over individuals of mixed ethnicity. Hmm. You know, who do you identify with? Who's your home? What community is your home? And that issue of who's with us and who's against us is, I think, a part of any social change movement, any sort of identity-based civil rights movement. And so I think – you're not really seeing anything new under the sun. It's the same sort of tension of who's with us, who's against us, applied to the domain of sexuality.
Do you see that changing at all?
I do see it changing. I think a part of it is that the bisexual community, and I have to give them great credit on this, has been increasingly active and vibrant in trying to fight biphobia, you know, within gay communities. And you know, I've spoken at a lot of different sort of community events. And one of the things that I've found sort of interesting is that, you know, here I am, a self-identified lesbian, talking about bisexual research. And I always used to feel uncomfortable that, oh, you know, they're going to be mad at me, like I'll be, you know, kind of going rah rah for the bisexuals, but I'm not one of you. And I was like, are they going to police their boundaries? And what I found was the opposite, huh, that they were like, you know what, we need, you know, lesbians and gay men speaking up for bisexuals. So they've actually been really proactive in not policing boundaries and in being much more, I think, open than I think the gay community sometimes has been. And I feel like, wow, we have a lot as a community. I think we have a lot to learn about the way that they've responded to their own marginalization. They responded to it by trying to be much more open and inviting. I think in the larger cities where there are more active bisexual communities, the gay communities tend to be more accepting and open, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in Chicago. But I think it's a slow process.
Do you think that as things have been changing lately related to gay marriage bans falling throughout the country, you're seeing the numbers of people who are willing to accept, you know, same-sex marriage changing dramatically over just the past couple of – if that's going to take the pressure off of the gay community to sort of maybe lighten up a little bit on the question of bisexuality.
You know, it's really interesting because the question of bisexuality has been a real sticky wicket even the phrase gay marriage is not quite right, right? You can be a bisexual person who's in a same-sex marriage, or you can have a bisexual person in an opposite-sex marriage. So is it gay marriage that we're talking about, or is it same-sex marriage, or whose rights are we talking about? And the debate over same-sex marriage is often undertaken as if what's going on with bisexuals is completely irrelevant and, in fact, threatening. And in some of the briefs that I've seen filed in various, you know, court cases for same-sex marriage, some folks have used the existence of bisexuality like, well, if some people can choose, you know, who to marry, then this is not even an issue at all, right? Maybe everyone can. So it's as if the existence of bisexuals is a threat to same-sex marriage. So I think that the community really hasn't resolved what the relevance of bisexuality to that whole debate is. I mean, I've actually thought that an underutilized argument is that if you look at bisexuals, you know, choosing whether to be with a same-sex partner or an other-sex partner, it reminds me of you know, Loving versus Virginia, right? And the whole debates over interracial marriage. No one ever argued that if you could fall in love with a white person, then as a white person, we shouldn't protect your right to marry a black person. Because if there's any chance you can fall in love with a white person, then just kind of go that way. And we don't have to worry. You know, like, no one had to prove that they were only attracted to other race people in order to protect a right to interracial marriage.
The point was you had a choice to whomever you wanted.
Yeah, the point is that, like, you know, marriage is your business.
Yeah.
And, like, it doesn't matter whether your body is forcing you to be attracted to someone of another race. It's a privacy issue. And I think that that is the most useful analogy to bisexuality. Like, you shouldn't it's not a question of whether you have no choice but to want something. You should have the right to protect whatever kind of intimate relationship you have, whether it was chosen, whether it was not, whether you're forced to be in it or not. And I sort of wish that the gay community would go further with that. I think often the rhetoric that you hear is, you know, this is the person I love, and this will, I can't possibly, you know, feel any other way. And I sort of want to say, but that shouldn't even be an issue for marriage. The question of whether we should feel sorry for you because you have this condition of gayness that forces you to only want to marry, you know, I feel like that shouldn't even be the issue. The issue should be more similar to interracial marriage. Like, I don't know how you fell in love with that person, but that's great. That's, you know, your choice of how to protect that relationship.
So it'll be interesting to see how, let's say, the Supreme Court, a lot of people are saying the Supreme Court may overturn all of these gay marriage bans. So once you get that out of the way, there may be a broader, more open conversation about sexuality.
I hope so. And I think, you know, I think there are a lot of individuals in the community who have felt for a while that although this is an important debate, the debate over same-sex marriage, that there are plenty of other issues that our community has to worry about. And As some activists would say, getting the law into our bedroom isn't really my number one priority, right? So there, I think that in many ways, one of the benefits, if that debate resolves itself positively in the near future, that as a community we can move on to some of these other things, like the incredible mental and physical health risks that are facing the largest and most understudied portion of our community.
Professor Lisa Diamond, Professor of Psychology and Gender Studies at the University of Utah. Her book called Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. Professor, thank you very much for the time.
Pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. With thanks to Michael Shea, as always. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.